Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about a new Scientist cover article from the 30th of June 2018. Now, with Cosmos magazine, which I read from, I've got permission from the and actually encouragement from the actual magazine, so I'll actually write to New Scientist, but this is part of my general rehab, just learning to podcast and read and do things that at all it gets part of the cognitive stuff about. The actual article is how to think about, and these are the various things. I can't see the actual author here, and I'll just read it through. There's 13 things that they want to talk about. So, science is the best guide we have to the often inscrutable world, but helping us understand our surroundings and ourselves, science and technology has spawned some lofty concepts, from black holes to blockchains, from consciousness to the multiverse. Then there are ideas like time and particles, genes and gender. Science probings like made newly complex. Over the next 13 pages, we explore these more and see how we can all think about them like prose. Beautiful, beautifully written. The topics are the multiverse, consciousness, time, particles, genes, Schrodinger's cats, logic, life, gender, entropy, the blockchain, black holes, scientific truth. This will be interesting. Number one, how to think about the multiverse. Just don't say they made it up. One of the most common misconceptions is the multi-universe is a hypothesis, says Sean Carroll at California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. In fact, it's forced upon us. It's a prediction of theories we have a good reason to think are correct. The idea that already the vast universe we can see is just one of perhaps infinitely many we can't is certainly a lot to swallow. And it doesn't stop there. The multiverse itself comes in many guises. Like the cosmological multiverse, this concept sprouts from internal inflation. Our best explanation for why the universe looks as it does in a split second after the Big Bang, the idea goes, space-time expanded exponentially. Random quantum effects brought this inflation to an end in small regions, and these became more sedately expanding bubble universes like ours inside a continuing ballooning container, budding off more and more bubbles. Even if we travel close to the speed of light, we couldn't reach the boundary of our expanding bubble, says Alexander Vinken, a theorist at Tufts University in Massachusetts, let alone cross over to another part of the multiverse. We probably wouldn't find it friendly for life like us. The so-called constants of nature, like the mass of the electron or Newton's gravitational constants, will have different values in different bubbles, says Vilken. Or at least so says string theory, our best stab theory of everything, which predicts a vast landscape of at least 10 to the 500 different configurations of physics. Then there is the quantum multiverse, predicted by the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory. It says that when we make a measurement of a quantum world, forcing it to snap out of the custom fuzzy state, there's possible measurements outcomes persist in worlds parallel to our own. Things get really hairy when you ask where these worlds are. If the bubble universe exists in the same physical space, the many worlds are truly parallel. The universe is completely separate from one another, says Vinken. There is a bigger mathematical structure that they're all inside, but in no sense does it look like space, says Carroll. What's more, copies of ourselves could exist in all these worlds, although the universes would have absolutely no physical connection with our own. So we didn't worry about the fate of our doppelgangers. Many of the worlds has no impact whatsoever on my decision, says Carol. You're talking about a person I can never talk to. You might as well worry about people who live millions of years from now or have lived million years ago. Okay, as a quantum physicist, I have some problems with this. This is because they've stuck to measuring waves with the particle viewpoint. So on the quantum, I need a bit more to get into that. But the multiverse is again interesting, especially inflation, what's going on in there. But I'm also a bit iffy the anthropological viewpoint, that the fact that we have these constants because we're alive. We observe conditions uniform for life because we are alive. Think about consciousness. It's a concept so intrinsic to the fabric, this is number two, to the fabric of reality, that starting to pick away at it leaves us feeling quite unraveled. We come closer to defining what it is to be an elephant than it is to be conscious, says Nicholas Shea, who researches philosophy in the mind at University of Oxford. Consciousness is the essence of what it is to be you. It's your subjective experiences from the feeling of the sun's warmth on your skin to the desolation grief conjured up somehow in your brain. It still seems to many people, sometimes to me, very hard to see how things happening in the physical world could give us rise to any sort of consciousness experience at all. This is neuroscientist Anil Seth at the University of Sussex in UK. Explaining the phenomena has been dubbed the hard problem, and the worry is that we may be too close to it to ever figure it out. Thinking about consciousness means you have to be conscious, but can the human brain ever understand itself? Shea thinks so. It looks deep and complex and intractable, but people are applying the scientific method, he says. Whatever does that mean? Okay. One school of thought is that if you can work out the physical brain activity that leads to, say, the visual experience of being read, something being read, then you can generalize to other conscious experiences. Another approach is what Seth calls a divide and conquer strategy. The aim here is to break consciousness down into different types of experiences, he says. What happens when you fall asleep and wake up? The relationship between visual perception and what's really out there. And you can also think about it yourself in emotion. Tackling these problems one by one makes consciousness seem easier to grasp. If you do that, then, after a while, there's maybe no remaining mystery, says Seth. But others believe that even if you could map out the entire brain and what it's doing, you'd still be in the dark about consciousness. When it comes to explaining what it is to be me or you, we seem to be to want the kind of answers that we don't really ask for in other parts of sciences, says Seth. That may be because if we crack how consciousness works, it threatens our sense of self and our notions of free will. When you start to explain that voluntary actions and experiences of intending to do things are just another kind of experience that depends on the brain, then you get quite a lot of resistance, he says. One way of the rabbit hole, he says, Seth, is to keep in mind what kind of free will is important. We want to be able to behave according to our beliefs and desires. It is possible no matter where consciousness experiences come from. In other words, I can choose what I want to do, but I can't choose what I want, says. He says that's by Catherine. Oh, that's they're by different authors. That's by Catherine Larange. Three. Now think about how to think about time. Never trust a physicist to tell you the time, says Marina Cortes of the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. Physics is has a slightly different idea about what time is. We used to think that we had it nailed. Time was a tick-tock of a clock somewhere outside the universe against which all processes could be measured. This is appealing intuitive idea of absolute time underpinning things like Newton's classical laws of motion and even the distinctly non-intuitive workings of quantum equations, our best description of the nitty-gritty of our reality. Never mind where the were never where these external readings of times would come from, Einstein's theory of relativity blew away the whole idea. Einstein showed that space and time are, well, relative. Both are part of unified space-time that is warped by both gravity and motion, so there is no two observers can ever fully agree on what happened there when. The discrepancies are imperceptible to us because we live the whole of our lives in roughly the same gravitational field and at roughly the same low speeds. That's beautifully written. I love that. We are deceived into thinking time is absolute by the accident of circumstances, physicist Carlo Rovelli at Aix-Marseille University in France, author of The Order of Time. In our experience, time passes at the same rate, but this is the only truth for the non-relativistic approximation in which we live. So, rule one in thinking clearly about time, cast the idea that it always ticks at the same rate. Rule two, be prepared to deny it ticks at all. In our experience, we are carried in the Chorusal of eternal presence down an inexorable stream of time from past to future. But physics says no, time to time's flow. Quantum theory indicates things should work just as well backwards as forward. Meanwhile, relativity is difficulty in putting events in any unambiguous order leads to physicists to suggest that reality is static in four-dimensional blocks of space-time in which all time exists all at once. Okay, most physicists explain away the illusion that time flows by appealing to the
bloody thing. I deliberately said nothing at the entire time because I knew you were going to criticise. I just said a thing. B, leave Sebastian alone. I didn't say anything.
You did
anything.
Say those things, though.
You were focusing on everything I said. I deliberately said nothing because I knew you were going to focus on.
You commented as we were coming in that you said that doesn't look like the kid did it. I can't say you didn't say that.
I didn't say anything aloud. I was. It doesn't really matter, but you've got something on it. Like there was, like I was being pushed from.
Now
is not the time. I'm sorry, Sebastian. I said nothing. I was completely
quiet. Okay, Rick was quite concerned that you were going.
You said that, and I didn't say anything. Yeah, it's lovely.
He showed us it. It was very quick. He wasn't near his machine.
I did see Toby. Yeah, I did see Toby.
You did see him.
Yeah. He just wasn't there with the machine. Yeah. We saw it work once.
He's probably run out of skittles. I have to go and restock.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think.
I think it's maybe because they're using.
I was amazed at that, but.
See you, Mary.
Come and help.
Clear biological boundaries between men and women are difficult to define, as the International Association for the Athletics Federation discovered following the case of Caster Sim, a female South African runner with an unusually high testosterone level, who won the 800 metres world title in 2009. There is no clear distinction between male and female brains. Whatever the measure we took at the structure connections activity, there's always more overlap than difference between males and female brains, says neuroscientists Lisa and Rosalind Franklin, University of Medicine at Science in Chicago. So perhaps it's time to ditch the binary thinking about gender. Gender differences fall onto a continuum, not onto a scale of separate buckets, says Fausto Sterling. Issue 10, think about entropy. Place 20 coins heads up on a tray and film it as you give it a shake. They play the flame backwards from the jumbled mess of coins, they all jump into the rest of the same side up, an unreal, slightly creepy sequence. It seems like a mundane observation, but actually this is very profound, says physicist Sadhu Prosperi of the University of Bristol, UK. This little experiment illustrates the power of perhaps the most essential implacable field of physics thermodynamics, the science of heat, energy, and most crucially, entropy. The roots of thermodynamics lies in the efforts to understand steam engines that powered the Industrial Revolution in the 18th and 19th century Europe. The French engineer Sadi Carnot realized that the heat always tends to dissipate, moving to cooler regions. Anything that goes against the grain requires additional energy to power it. This movement from hotter to cooler is an expression of a more fundamental drive in the universe. The disorder, as measured by entropy, always increases. The specifics don't matter. Heat always flows. Flipped coins always jumble. Burning logs always turn into ash. If we discover a new force tomorrow, thermodynamics will be fine, says Jonathan Oppenheim at the University of College London. Entropy increases so universal that many physicists propose this is why we see time flowing. It certainly is why our hearts must constantly pump blood, supplying ourselves with energy that as a temporary stay against the inevitable onset of decay and disorder. Is there a way out? Perhaps the laws of thermodynamics only hold true as statistical average. As a result, some see an escape route. What? From a entropy's inevitable rise in the small-scale workings of the quantum world. Rules based on statistics don't mean much when you're dealing with just a few particles. There are concepts akin to entropy that tend to increase in the quantum world, says Oppenheim, certainly over particles' positions for once. The science of quantum thermodynamics is in its infancy, and any hopes of using fuzzy rules to make batteries more efficient and conventional eventually possible will not be realized anytime soon. Oppenheim is skeptical that we will ever override the traditional thermodynamics restrictions, but one instance where quantum thermodynamics comes to play is at the event horizon of black hole. Think about black holes. So it could solve some enduring riddle how to unite general relativity and quantum theory. It's unlikely to help much with the bleak future predicted in the universe, in which it slides into a long, slow heat death, eventually turning all order into disorder. Our present understanding is that things will become more and more disordered until life becomes very, very boring, Oppenheim. Or will it? Even with disordered soup at the end of the universe, in theory, all kinds of interesting things can occur, says Oppenheim. Perhaps the most bizarre of these was first expanded by Ludwig Boltzmann in 1896. Lordman argued that given time large enough in the universe, fluctuations might randomly create a sub-universe that looks like ours. More plausibly, it might create a brain that thinks like us, thinks it exists in such a universe, and thinks that entropy is always on the up. I think that's a Boltzmann brain. I think that's a little bit confused there. Who was that by? Joshua Haugiger. It was looking good. Disappointing. Okay, number 11. Blockchain. I'd like to understand this a bit better. Think about the blockchain. Really, before such an obscure and complex technology captured the popular imagination, quite like the one announced in the nerdy corner of the internet in 2008 by inventor Satoshi Nakamoto, a mysterious person or persons whose real identity still isn't known for certain. The metaphors used to describe the blockchains are appropriately gabby too. It's mind virus, it's the internet of money, it's the end of capitalism. Or think of it like a bicycle, says Nolan Berg, a cryptocurrency news site CoinDesk. We had wheels and chains and saddles, but the magic happened when the things were made into roll on two wheels and everyone said, oh my goodness, I think that's possible. All clear? Well, this much we do know. The blockchain is invented to build trust in the first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, a digital decentralized way to move money. Bitcoin's roots are in anarcho-capitalism, a movement that aspires to reproduce the mechanisms of the free market without the need for banks, state bodies, and enforceable rules, or to enforce rules. It was designed to get governments and law enforcement out of the way, said William Cotton Belt of Imperial College London. Blue chip buzzword. In effect, the blockchain is simply a database. It stores arbitrary information such as Bitcoin transactions and units called block. New blocks get stuck onto the end of an ever-growing chain via some heavyweight number crunching and copied to many computers on the internet. The elaborate distributed process makes blockchains tamper-proof, an unfalsifiable record of transactions that made it. There are now hundreds of different blockchains powering projects from using trading solar power to real estate to tracking provenance of food and diamonds to enabling new forms of voting. Sprouting far from its roots, blockchain is also embraced by governments, banks, and blue-chip companies to secure an efficient way to log transactions. In the first week of 2018, Bloomberg accounted 110 company press releases using the buzzword compared to 5 of the same period the year before. Beneath the corporate hype, blockchains could generally bring greater transparency to government spending or bank transactions, for example, because they are cut out the middlemen such as real estate agents and could make buying and selling property quicker and cheaper. A potential bubble popper, however, is the rise of crypto crime. New cryptocurrencies such as Zcash and Monero run on a souped-up blockchains that obfuscate the transaction list, making it hard to see who paid what to whom. Such anomaly makes it unpoliceable form of money that seems almost an open invitation to criminals looking to make nefarious transactions. It's almost frightening what they've done here, says Cotton Belt. But the most dramatic downside to technology presents the need to guzzle energy, because the vast amounts of computing power required to add new blocks to the blockchains. Last November, the Bitcoin blockchains alone started to consume more electricity than Ecuador, and the appetites have only grown since. Now, that's an interesting thing. That is really interesting. Information and energy, there's actually equations on that. Item 12, think about black holes. The starting point is familiar enough. A black hole is part of a space-time so incredibly warped that the gravity becomes incredibly intense that nothing can escape, not even light, says physicist Pedro Fitter of Oxford University. That is one of where the problems begin. Black holes are a cast-iron prediction of general relativity, Einstein's peerless theory of gravity, and yet they stretch to breaking point as equations fail catastrophically at a black hole's center known as the singularity, where the warping of space-time simply goes off scale. Everything you calculate goes to infinity, and it has no meaning. Even Einstein thought the black holes were too absurd to be real. They emit no light, so we cannot see them, and yet we can infer their presence by the influence on nearby matter as they suck the gas and dust into stars and the contortions which produce an awesome light shows. In 2015, when we detected the gravitational waves for the first time, the observed ripples in space-time matched the predicted signals from two black holes spiraling into one each other and merging. Actually, black holes are rather common. Space is pockmarked with ones formed from overmassive stars collapse and die. Our galaxy alone holds perhaps 100 million of these small black holes. Most galaxies also have a humongous one at the center. The one at the heart of the Milky Way packs in 4 million solar masses in a region that would fit it inside the orbit of Mercury. So far, you can think about something so extreme that even abstract mathematics can't predict it. The difficulty is, it turns out, I have a mental picture of a classical black hole in terms of deformed space-time, like a trampoline with a very heavy weight on it, says Steve Gildings, the University of California, Santa Barbara. The problem is that classical pictures ultimately fails at a fundamental level. To get down to the nitty-gritty of what happens at a black hole's point of no return is the event horizon, you need to bring in quantum theory into the picture. But quantum theory and general relativity famously don't agree. We think about what happens to information if it falls into a black hole. We run into conundrum so severe it suggests that there's something deeply wrong with our classical description of space-time, says Gilding. General relativity says that when matter falls into a black hole, the information is destroyed. Quantum mechanics says it can't be. The unified theory requires us to do something to reconcile the two, probably a reimagining space-time as only an approximate thing, says Gilding. String theory offers one way. It might turn what we think black holes are into fuzzballs with no singularity and no event horizon. Dense star-like objects that essentially amount to a tangled ball of space-time string. Or perhaps not, and that's precisely why black holes are so tempting, says Pierre Natarajan, astronomer at the Yale University. I actually describe them as seductive, she says. They lie on the margin of what is knowable and what's not. Daniel Cossins. Well, that really hasn't improved, does it? Okay, the last one is scientific truth. Vienna, 1919, a city scarred by the lost war and empire. Navel-gazing is in order, and Sigmund Freud's new idea of subconsciousness and psychoanalysis are all the rage. One apprentice cabinet maker is brooding. How could anyone prove them true when the subconscious is unknowable? Karl Popper soon abandoned the cabinet making for a loftier pursuit. He wanted to find a way to demark ideas like Freud's from what he saw as true account of knowledge science. It still isn't all that easy. By its nature, science can't rely on logical deduction alone or build up on knowledge purely from incontestable truths. It must make leaps to the unknown, just as Freud did, formulating hypotheses and searching for the evidence and the truth. This is called induction and hides a niggle described by philosopher David Hume 150 years before Popper. A classic example involves checking the colour of as many swans as you can find, then extrapolating the rule saying the swans are white. That sounds like science, but it can lead to it can't lead to reliable knowledge, Hume argued, because you can never know a black swan isn't in the next pond. Popper's resolution seems oddly negative. Science is about proving, not proving truth, but falsehood. A crucial thing is that when you find evidence that disproves the scientific hypothesis, you discard or amend that hypothesis. You can never find truth exactly, but slowly pulling out ideas, you edge closer to it. When at some point the weight of evidence seems overwhelming, your hypothesis becomes a scientific theory, like general theory of relativity. Okay, the theory of evolution by natural selection and the theory of human-induced climate change. Ugh, don't like that. The thing, scientists don't stick to Popper's strict criteria in practice and often follow their hunches and look to confirm rather than refute theories. The thing about scientific methodology is that it defies simple summary, says James Layman, a philosopher at the Science of University of Bristol. You can't always apply the principles in the context of a specific way. I actually agree with that particular aspect of it. That is, that it's something, the scientific practice is something that cannot be easily summarised. With no way for us to say the theory is definitely true, the door is left wide open for alternative facts, especially when the conclusions of empirical studies are incompatible with this climate change. Oh my God. At things can easily sound scientific when they're not, especially when they play to prejudices or make or confirmation biases. Or make the news. Take the study from last year that claimed to have found genes that determine whether people like Marmite, a yeast breakfast popular in the UK, involved DNA test statistics sample of 261. So far scientific, but the study was conducted. That meant that it had no power to connect the cause and effect. Yeah, this is significance. Okay. 2015, indeed, one study found a third of research papers in psychology appear to have reached spurious conclusions. Lederman's answer is that science is not one thing, but a set of related disciplines. When it comes to the ability to purvey truth, we need to distinguish clearly between utterly reliable physics of tide tables, say, and the messier ends of psychology. That said, how did we uncover the crisis of psychology research? Through science, when scientists thought to replicate results and failed. Without blemishes, it ain't, but science is at least uniquely willing to stare itself in the mirror. I would say that. To corrupt a Winston Churchill quote, it is probably the worst way of seeking truth, apart from all others that have been tried from time to time. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.